I think it's an area that's becoming more difficult for diplomats generally because of the age that we live in. It's much more, you know, open and transparent than in the past. We've got the Freedom of Information Act. We've got things like WikiLeaks, you know, which for the first time exposed thousands of private cables.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there's a real challenge for us when we report what people say to us. You know, I always think to myself, how would I feel if this leaked?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. This week, we're going to delve, into the life of a diplomat. My guest is Menna Rawlings, who has been the British High Commissioner to Australia since 2015. She's an absolutely delightful person, as I reckon this chat will attest. So here's our conversation about what it's like to be in the Foreign Service, how you navigate diplomacy in the age of WikiLeaks, and whether she ever feels like being decidedly undiplomatic. Listen up. Menna, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's great to be here, Catherine.
Now, let's start with you.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about your background, how it came to pass that you are now, well, you're about to go home, sadly.
Sadly.
But how you've arrived at being the most senior British diplomat in Australia.
So I'll try not to make it a super long story. I'll keep it short because I'm now 28 years into a diplomatic career, but to go right back to the start, you know, I had a very sort of ordinary upbringing. I wasn't sort of born into diplomatic life in any way at all. I went to a comprehensive school in Northwest London. My family are Welsh. We didn't really travel when I was young, except to go up and down a road called the M4, which is the motorway that links London to Wales. I think I first went abroad when I was 14 and I went to France on a French exchange. Didn't fly until I was 17. That was my first trip on a plane. But anyway, for whatever reason, I just had this massive desire as a child to travel and to see the world. And that was a huge driver for me. The other driver was that I'm fascinated by politics and by international relations and went on to study international relations at the London School of Economics. So I was looking for a career that combined this sort of, you know, urge, this curiosity to get out and see the world with a fascination with international affairs. And, you know, there's no better fit really than diplomacy. I was very lucky. I applied straight out of university and got into the Foreign Office.
And you presumably worked at home for a bit, but you've done other postings as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So you do a bit of time in London, and then I wanted to spend a lot of time overseas in terms of my career, because that was the whole point. And I think I've succeeded in that. So I've had postings in consecutive order, starting in Brussels, then Kenya, then Israel, then Ghana, then Washington DC, and then here. So this is my sixth overseas postings, with time in between back at head office in London. But proportionally, I've spent quite a lot of my time overseas, and it has been amazing, fascinating, wonderful. You know, there's ups and downs. It's not all cocktail parties and glamour.
Yes.
It can be quite difficult at times, depending on where you are. But it's a wonderful, wonderful career. And yeah, I'm delighted with how it's all turned out.
You've invited me, so let's drill down into that a little bit about the life. Because certainly from my vantage point, you know, being a diplomat sounds like a tremendous life.
Yeah.
Sounds fascinating at every level and just all kinds of fun.
Yeah.
But I bet it's not fun sometimes. So what's the life like? And you've mentioned that it can be difficult at times.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not asking you to breach confidences, but what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that?
So I think, first of all, it's very diverse. So, you know, you can be in a place like Australia, which is an incredibly easy place to live. But I've also lived in countries which themselves, you know, are wonderful in their own way, but are not necessarily easy, so have a high level of crime. Or in Israel, you know, very difficult politics. And I was in Israel during the time of the Second Intifada.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty tough, actually, with young kids, you know, with suicide bombs in Tel Aviv and, you know, appalling things happening in the occupied territories. So that can be quite hard. And, you know, when you're overseas, you're sort of, it's your whole life and you're very sort of immersed in it. and it can feel quite sort of claustrophobic when times are tough. And then I think there's other aspects of the work that can be quite sort of emotionally challenging. So in my speech yesterday at the press club, I talked quite a lot about consular work, you know, the work we do to help distressed British nationals, which I'm actually really passionate about. I think it's a really important part of what we do. And even while I've been here, you know, we've had some awful incidents that I have been quite involved with, just because it's such big, you know, they're big stories back home. They're, you know, very important in terms of getting it right, in terms of our response. So, you know, for example, while I was here, we had two young Brits killed in a stabbing near Townsville in a place called Home Hill. Mm-hmm. And I actually went up there for that and, you know, met the families, went to the crime scene, you know, talked to the police to make sure that, you know, they were doing all they could, which obviously they were. And, you know, things like that really stay with you. And I have been involved in a few consular cases over the years, which, you know, you just really have to sort of find a way to sort of deal with emotionally, because they are quite testing. But, you know, some of our staff deal with those sorts of cases all the time. Mm. So, you know, I really admire people that do that sort of work.
Yeah, it takes some fortitude, really, yeah, because, absolutely, you know, the people are involved in all kinds of terrible, you know, reversals of fortunes when they when they travel.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Some you might say bring it on themselves, others less so.
Yeah, I mean, obviously people who are careless with passports or whatever, I've got limited sympathy for, but, you know, when you've got vulnerable people, and some of the people who come here, you know, young Brits, they may never have been abroad before. They don't understand that Australia is a vast country and the remoteness of some of the places they're in. And they are quite vulnerable. So we do a lot of work to try to make sure, you know, they don't get into trouble or have awful things happen to them. Mm. But one of the reasons I think it's so important is because of the link between, it creates a link between what we do. You know, diplomacy can seem very sort of highfalutin and intellectual, and some of it's quite sort of secret and private. This is a real opportunity to engage with the British public. And I do think that in the era of sort of trust, you know, the sort of trust deficit issue that we all face, getting that right is really important.
Mm. What about with politicians? Because obviously I know you've got a very extensive network in Australia.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you have in your previous postings as well.
Yeah.
Getting that balance right, because, you know, you're a really warm and engaging woman. Anyone who's met you will
allegedly.
Well, it's you know, it's your legend, and it is in fact true. But you know, it would inspire confidence and the giving of confidences on the part of politicians.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, your job in Australia is to report back to the British government what's going on in Australia with a degree of depth and fluency and understanding.
Yeah.
But is it difficult sometimes to understand the line between somebody who becomes a friend of yours, and during your tenure you've had Julie Bishop and Penny Wong, two women in foreign postings, and I think you're pretty tight, the three of you.
Yeah.
So is it obvious where those lines are, what you report back and what you don't necessarily report back?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I think, I mean, I will answer your question, Catherine, honestly, but just as a sort of precursor to that, I think it's an area that's becoming more difficult for diplomats generally because of the age that we live in is much more, you know, open and transparent than in the past. We've got the Freedom of Information Act. We've got things like WikiLeaks, you know, which for the first time exposed thousands of private cables.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there's a real challenge for us when we report what people say to us. You know, I always think to myself, how would I feel if this leaked?
Mm.
And, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, you probably didn't have to think about that.
Well, no one would have thought that.
No
one would have
exactly.
conceived of the fact that these private communications would be in the public domain.
Absolutely.
But then, okay, sort of conversely, does it impede you in a way? Because it's sort of, you know, obviously I'm a journalist, I'm on the side of the more exposure, the better.
Yeah.
Transparency
good,
is
generally,
good,
yes,
generally,
yeah,
as a principle.
Yeah.
But I can also understand that perhaps sometimes it would be good to be frank in communications back home, but perhaps you hesitate now.
Yeah, again, I think you're getting to a really important issue, and I don't think there's not one answer to how we handle that, because I also believe it's really important that we can still speak truth to power. And if you inhibit yourself too much in terms of your analysis or, you know, the extent to which you report private conversations, then you're not really giving, you're not really doing your job as well as you need to. Mm. So I think it's just being really careful. It's, you know, it's limiting distribution if you're sharing something quite personal. It's if you really worried about it, you pick up the phone and give the message verbally. So there's more of that, I think, than there used to be. Mm. And I think you've just got to find ways to manage it, because like you, I agree that the principle is right. And I think we just have to work hard to define the boundary between, you know, what's private and keep that tighter versus what we can be more open about. Because in general, I think there's scope to be more open about more of what we do. Mm. But just to go back to your question about sort of, you know, how do you draw the line with sort of contacts versus friends? And I think it's very... It's very sort of, you know, sort of touch and feel. I don't think there's a straightforward answer to that. And, you know, I don't kid myself that a lot of the people I meet through my job are necessarily going to stay in touch with me or be my best mate once I'm back in the UK. But you do definitely make those connections which just go a bit deeper. And it's a real privilege to meet people from both sides of the house, actually, who are just wonderful people. You know, I feel... It's interesting, the abuse that politicians get, because I'm sure you see the same thing. A lot of them actually are really, really decent people.
Yeah, that's right.
So when you do have that connection, it is really nice. You know, there's definitely a handful that, you know, I know I'll keep in touch with and hope to see again in the future, either in the UK or here.
Mm-hmm. And just one more professional conundrum before we move on to Australia and your observations about it.
Yes.
Do you ever, as a diplomat, and this is me talking, this is me projecting my entire personality onto you, my dear. I'm sorry about that. But do you ever just think to yourself, Christ, I'm sick of being polite. I'd really love just to drop a truth bomb in this conversation. You know, just sort of get out of the diplomatic formulations and just go the nut. Do you ever want to go the nut?
I mean, I think there is space to be blunt sometimes. Mm-hmm. And again, one of the things I was talking about at the press club was being a bit more Aussie sometimes. We Brits, we are so polite. And I think, you know, we carry so much with us in terms of we've got all this colonial baggage that we drag with us around the world. We're sort of worried about being perceived as, you know, elite or arrogant or anything. And we're very, very polite. And actually, I've sort of, one of the things I've got from Australian diplomats and others is just say what you know, say what you mean and be a bit more direct. And our relationship, I think, is fantastic in terms of the overall UK-Australia relationship. And it can take a bit of truth and a bit of bluntness. So, and I think I've been able to do that as I've sort of developed in this role. But just dropping complete truth bombs, I mean, not really. I mean, you know, I never feel like, to be honest, just saying, sorry, that's a load of...
You're a shithead, say.
That doesn't really go through my head.
No.
But, you know, again, I think we all have a private side as well.
Sure.
And there's sort of one or two people at home who I might go home, you know, shut the door and then have a private rant.
Yes.
But, you know, that's private.
Yes, of course.
I wouldn't necessarily feel I need to bring that into the meeting with whoever.
Well, you can see everybody by that answer, the diplomatic response to would you ever be unprofessional? The answer is no. So, you know, it's good that it's good we cleared that up.
Yeah,
it's good that
absolutely right.
Good we cleared that up. Yeah. All right, let's move on to Australia.
Yes.
And your observations of Australia, because I'm fascinated how Australia looks through British eyes at the moment.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of, I mean, I look at British politics at the moment, look at Brexit and think, oh, my God, like really, oh, my God. And it periodically, this is the wrong word to invoke here, but it reassurance that I think to myself, okay, we're pretty mad in Australia, like we are pretty diabolically mad in our politics. But we, like Brexit hasn't happened yet, so thank the Lord, I think. But so that's what I think of your politics. What do you think of ours? What do you think of ours? I've opened the way by saying up front, it is mad, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think it's a bit messy.
That's a nice
euphemism. It's the way I put it. And I think, you know, we have to put it in context, though. I mean, it's not only in the UK or Australia where we have certain challenges within our political systems. I mean, there's a lot going on in liberal and a lot of liberal democracies around the world. And I think, you know, you need to sort of step back a bit and think, well, you know, why is that? What is driving the sort of wider rise of populism, the sort of fragmentation, I think, of politics around the world? Mm.
And what is, do you think?
Well, how long have we got?
No, well, exactly. We have a time. What do you think?
I don't think there's a straightforward answer. I think it's lots of things. I think it is partly sort of the age of social media and technology, increasing the level of scrutiny of politicians and institutions, and people sometimes not liking some of what they see, and that creating a sort of disaffection with politicians or political systems. I think that's one thing. I think another thing, certainly in the UK, and even in Australia to some extent, is the sort of the backwash, that's probably not the right word, the sort of the legacy of the global financial crisis, and this sense of sort of stalling personal prosperity, and people being pretty fed up with that, wanting something different or better for themselves and their families. I think that's part of it as well. And I think the third thing is probably globalisation, sort of writ large, and, you know, some of the pressures that creates. I mean, all of the positives, you know, which I see and I'm sure you see, but there are some impacts as well. And so, for example, you know, migration and the ease with which people can move around the world and, you know, moving to other countries, I think, does present cultural challenges, which some people find more difficult than others to adapt to. So a sort of mixture of those things.
But
what do you think, though, Catherine?
Well,
I mean, does that sound...
No. I wouldn't disagree with anything you've said. I'm a bit intrigued by the nativism and the backlash against migration, whether or not it's a factor or it's enhanced by people's sense of their own falling, their own declining prosperity. And I think I'm sort of intrigued whether that's, migration is obviously is a rancid, at times toxic issue in Australian politics. Yeah. But it still lurks below the level of what we're seeing in continental Europe and the UK and the US.
Yeah.
And I think in my own mind, the economy's got to be because the economy is the major difference between those parts of the world.
Although it's also space and size.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, the UK is a small country. Australia's 31 and a half times the size of the UK with, a third of the population, something like that.
Yeah.
So I think the pressures are felt much more keenly alongside, you know, a bigger impact from things like the GFC on living standards. And you put those things together, I think you're absolutely right. Mm. And that's where you sort of get some of the rub. I mean, the population of the UK has gone up 2.5 million in the last 5 years, you know, which is half the size of the population of New Zealand. So, you know, whatever our views about whether migration is a good thing or a bad thing or a mixed thing, it is a thing.
Mm.
And I think, it doesn't fall equally in terms of the impact on different societies and different people. You know, that said, you know, just to be clear, you know, I'm incredibly proud of the multiculturalism that we have in the UK. And when you look at a city like London, which is a prosperous city, where now I think only 44% of the London demographic is actually white British, you know, it's actually a fantastic success story.
Absolutely.
But the problem is it's not a success story that people who are on the periphery in the UK recognise or think is helpful to their own sort of standard of living.
Yeah.
And that's why you get these sorts of gaps, I think, between city versus
the regions,
Going
on in the regions.
I think you see a bit of that here.
Oh,
as
definitely.
Well.
It's
you see
phenomenon.
A sort of echo of that.
Yeah, definitely.
Here.
Definitely. 100%.
Yeah.
And so, sort of things that are particularly idiosyncratic about Australia? What stuck out? I just remember, when sort of our London colleagues from The Guardian came out to set up our operation here, there was some vernacular, for example, that took a bit of, there was a whiteboard for a period of time with words that people hadn't heard of, you know, sort of our kind of iterations of English that were foreign to some of our colleagues, which was quite fun, actually.
Yeah.
But it's more than just obviously kind of getting across the vernacular. What struck you as kind of, I don't know, whoa, about Australia that's quite different or that you didn't expect?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say is it's so similar. It's ludicrous, actually.
Yeah.
So I remember arriving here, you know, and you travel 10,000 miles to get here, and then you step out and you immediately feel at home because the culture and the humour and, of course, all of the history and heritage. But the sort of there's a sense of sort of shared experience, even though we're on opposite sides of the world, which, you know, is the thing that still strikes me the most. And I think those things are really important. But yeah, I mean, obviously there are differences, and we were joking about some of them yesterday at the press club. So, you know, Marmite versus Vegemite, you know, some of your sort of artists that, or, you know, stars that we're not familiar with, like Daryl Braithwaite,
yes.
And the obsession with the horses at the end of any sort of, you know, fun night is a bit of a puzzle. And, you know, it's like anything, the more you're here, the more you sort of notice some of the differences. I think Australians are more sort of direct than the Brits. I think they're more informal. They are fun. And I think they've got a healthier respect for a work-life balance in general. Not that you might feel in your job.
That's an aspiration, but anyway, we'll get there. No,
I know. Life and of nature and of, you know, the importance of time with family and friends. Yeah. And I think that's, I really admire that. I like that a lot.
Climate change.
Yes.
We have to go there, my dear. Because that is one of the major differences. It sort of strikes me because in the British experience of climate change, we have... Well, it's sort of basically not been an artifact of partisan politics, not for, I don't know, maybe it was at some point, but it hasn't been. And so Britain seems to have been able to come to terms with the challenges of climate change in a bipartisan fashion, largely. Maybe this analysis is terribly superficial, you'll tell me if it is, and sort of just really got on with it. Now, in Australia, as you know, it's, you know, we're stuck on this endless roundabout of, well, I'll say it, idiocy about this issue. Why?
Yeah. I mean, just in the UK, first of all, I mean, I think you're right that this is largely a bipartisan issue and that there's been a lot of progress under successive governments of different sides of the House. And, you know, we are proud. I'm proud of our record, actually, in terms of what we've done to reduce emissions. I think it's right to say we've cut emissions by 43% since 1990. And our emissions are now what they were in 1897 or something like that. But, you know, there's still more to do. And in fact, we're falling slightly short at the moment in terms of our very ambitious targets. So it was a real surprise when I came here to see it's such a political issue. And I've tried to think about, you know, why is that? What's different? And I think, you know, some of it is just political divides have to happen on something.
Yep.
You know, we've got Europe to have a big political row about constantly.
Yes.
You know, you've got this. I think it's partly perhaps, I don't know what you think, about the importance of the land and the earth here and, you know, coal being such an important part of Australia's prosperity.
Yes.
And a point I was making yesterday was, you know, we sort of transitioned out of coal in the 80s. We had that huge, awful fight then.
Yeah.
And I was in my teens then. I mean, there was nothing nice or bipartisan about it.
No,
you know, it felt like the coal mines were being sort of shut down prematurely and, you know, thousands of job losses, you know, Thatcher versus Scargill. It was awful at the time, but perhaps we sort of got it out of the way then. And this country sort of didn't go through that sort of transition at that time. And then I think maybe it's just that it's just one of those issues that because Australia is a long way away and hasn't, you know, doesn't really suffer or doesn't feel itself yet to suffer for some of the impact of this, it just doesn't feel real to enough people. But then you look at the opinion polls, if you look at the Lowy poll, climate change is something that 70% of Australians worry about.
Yeah.
So I suspect, you know, I suspect it's coming. And to be fair to Australia, putting my diplomatic hat back on, you know, they are committed to some emission reductions under the Paris Agreement. And we have confidence that those will be met.
Sorry, I'll laugh. That's lovely. That's lovely.
But it's true. It's true. You know, 26 to 28% reduction in net emissions by 2030.
Yes. Yeah, we have made that commitment. It's true. It's so, just, yes, we kind of lack the roadmap to get there, but I'm not going to push you on this point for obvious reasons.
Thank you.
So, what next? What next for you?
What next? Well, I'm going back to the UK with my family, which is driven as much by family considerations, actually, as anything else. I'm in that sort of classic sandwich generation, as it's called, with
parents,
you know, kids,
children.
Parents and kids. Mm. Yeah. So it's time to go home. We've been abroad a lot. So being home for a while will be good. Job wise, who knows? I'm sort of going into the Foreign Office sausage machine and hopefully they'll find something for me and I'll sort of be sort of spurted out the other end with a job, hopefully.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
But there's plenty going on. So I'm sure I'll find something challenging and interesting, although I'm not sure anything will be as good as this job because I've absolutely loved it. Mm. And I love Australia. I think it's a fantastic country with a very bright future ahead.
Oh, well, that's a lovely note to end on.
Absolutely.
So let's do it. Then.
Always end on a positive.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Thanks so much for coming on the
show. Thanks, Catherine. That was great. Thank you very much. Bye.
Well, thank you so much for listening. Of course, I really do appreciate it. It's the usual drill. Please do leave us a rating or a review wherever you download the podcast. We really do appreciate it. And of course, subscribe and share if you like the listening. It improves the viability of the project. Thanks as always to Miles and to Hannah for production. I'll be back next week. And till then, be well.